good horse, I called you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding,
you're listening to episode 566 of Unwelcome Guests. If not for the man, then for whom? I'm Robin Upton, and this week on the show, we're looking at an alternative to working for the man, inspired by Ivan Illich's Learning Webs, which we'll hear about more later on in the show. We've also got a conclusion of the Gatto interview that we've been serializing, but I thought we'd start with Erica Goldson, a plucky young valedictorian from a U.S. high school. This is her speech from July 7th, 2010. There is a story of a young but earnest Zen student who approached his teacher and asked the master, "If I work very hard and diligently, how long will it take for me to find Zen?" The master thought about this, then replied, 10 years. The student then said, "But if I work very, very hard and really apply myself to learn fast, how long then?" replied the master. "Well, 20 years." "But if I
really, really work at it, how long then?" asked the student. 30 years," replied the master. "But I do not understand," said the disappointed student. "At each time that I say I will work harder, you say that it will take me longer. Why do you say that?" replied the master. "When you have one eye on the goal, you only have one eye on the path." This is the dilemma that I face within the American public education system. We are so focused on a goal, whether it be passing a test or graduating as first in the class. However, in this way, we do not really learn at our fullest. We do whatever it takes to achieve our original objective. Some of you may be thinking, "Well, if you pass a test or become valedictorian, didn't you learn something?" Well, yes, you learned something, but not all that you could have. Perhaps you only learned how to memorize names, places, and dates to later on forget in order to clear your mind for the next test. School is not all that it can be. Right now, it's a place for most people to determine that their goal out is to get out as soon as possible. I'm now accomplishing that goal. I am graduating. I should look at this as a positive experience, especially being at the top of my class. However, in retrospect, I cannot say that I'm any more intelligent than my peers. I can attest that I am only the best at doing what I'm told. Here I stand, and I'm supposed to be proud that I have completed this period of indoctrination. I will leave in the fall, and I will go on to the next phase expected of me in order to receive a paper document that certifies that I'm capable of work. But I contest that I'm a human being, not just a worker. I'm a thinker, an adventurer. A worker is someone who is trapped within repetition, a slave of the system set up before him. But now I have successfully shown that I was the best slave. I did what I was told to the extreme. While others sat in class and doodled to later become great artists, I sat in class to take notes, to become a great test taker. While others would come to class without their homework done because they were reading about an interest of theirs, I never missed an assignment. While others were creating music and writing lyrics, I decided to do extra credit, even though I didn't even need it. So I wonder, why did I even want this position? Sure, I earned it, but what will come of it? When I leave educational institutionalism, will I be successful or forever lost? I have no clue about what I want to do with my life. I have no interest because I saw every subject as a study, as work, and I excelled at every subject just for the purpose of excelling and not learning. And quite frankly, I'm very scared. John Taylor Gatto, a retired school teacher and activist critical of compulsory schooling, asserts, "We could encourage the best qualities of youthfulness, curiosity, adventure, resilience, the capacity for surprising insight simply by being more flexible about time, texts, and tests, by introducing kids into truly competent adults and by giving each student what autonomy he or she needs in order to take a risk every now and then. But we don't do that. Between these cinder block walls, we are all expected to be the same. We are trained to ace every standardized test, and those who deviate and see light through a different lens are worthless to the scheme of public education, and therefore viewed with contempt. H.L. Mencken wrote in the American Mercury for April 1924 that the aim of public education is not to fill the young of this species with knowledge and awaken their intelligence. Nothing could be further from the truth. The aim is simply to reduce as many individuals as possible to the same safe level, to breed and train a standardized citizenry, to put down dissent and originality. That is the aim in the United States. To illustrate this idea, doesn't it perturb you to learn about the idea of critical thinking? Is there really such a thing as uncritically thinking? To think is to process information in order to form an opinion. But if we are not critical when processing this information, are we really thinking? Or are we mindlessly accepting other opinions as truth? This was happening to me, and if it wasn't for the rare occurrence of an avant-garde 10th grade English teacher, Donna Bryan, I would have been doomed. I am now enlightened, but my mind still feels disabled. I must retrain myself and constantly remember how insane this ostensibly sane place really is. And now here I am in a world guided by fear, a world suppressing the uniqueness that lies inside each of us, a world where we can either acquiesce to the inhuman nonsense of corporatism and materialism or insist on change. We are not enlivened by an educational system that clandestinely sets us up for jobs that could be automated, for work that need not be done, for enslavement without fervency for meaningful achievement. We have no choices in life when money is our motivational force. Our motivational force ought to be passion, but this is lost from the moment we step into a system that trains us rather than inspires us. We are more than robotic bookshelves conditioned to blurt out facts we were taught in school. We are all very special. Every human on this planet is very special. So aren't we all deserving of something better? Of using our minds for innovation rather than memorization, for creativity rather than futile activity, for rumination rather than stagnation? We are not here to get a degree, to then get a job, so we can consume industry-approved placation after placation. There is more and more still. The saddest part is that the majority of students don't have the opportunity to reflect as I did. The majority of students are put through the same brainwashing techniques in order to create a complacent labor force working in the interests of large corporations and secretive government. And worst of all, they are completely unaware of it. I will never be able to turn back these 18 years. I can't run away to another country with a different education system, perhaps meant to enlighten rather than condition. This part of my life is over, and I want to make sure that no other child will have his or her potential suppressed by powers meant to exploit and control. We are human beings. We are thinkers, dreamers, explorers, artists, writers, engineers. We are anything we want to be, but only if we have an educational system that supports us rather than holds us down. A tree can grow, but only if its roots are given a healthy foundation. For those of you out there that must continue to sit in desks and yield to the authoritarian ideologies of instructors, do not be disheartened. You still have the opportunity to stand up, ask questions, be critical, and create your own perspective. Demand a setting that will provide you with intellectual capabilities that allow you to expand your mind instead of directing it. Demand that you be interested in class. Demand that the excuse, you have to learn this for the test, is not good enough for you. Education is an excellent tool, if used properly, but focus more on learning rather than getting good grades. For those of you that work within the system that I am condemning, I do not mean to insult. I intend to motivate. You have the power to change the incompetencies of the system. I know that you did not become a teacher or an administrator to see your students bored. You cannot accept the authority of the governing bodies that tell you what to teach, how to teach, and that you will be punished if you do not comply. Our potential is at stake. For those of you that are now leaving this establishment, I say, do not forget what went on in these classrooms. Do not abandon those that come after you. We are the new future, and we are not going to let tradition stand. We will break down the walls of corruption to let a garden of knowledge grow throughout America. Once educated properly, we will be cultivated and wise. We will have the power to do anything, and best of all, we will use that power for only good. We will not accept anything at face value. We will ask questions, and we will demand truth. So here I stand. I'm not standing here as valedictorian by myself. I was molded by my environment, by all my peers who are sitting here behind me. I couldn't have accomplished this without all of you. It was all of you who truly made me the person I am today. It was all of you who were my competition, yet my backbone. In that way, we are all valedictorians. I am now supposed to say farewell to this institution, those who maintain it, and those who stand with me and behind me, but I hope this farewell is more of a see you later, when we are all working together to rear a pedagogic movement. But first, let's go get those pieces of paper that tell us that we're smart enough to do so.
Well, I think she's spot on as far as fear being crucial to this society and to people's abandoning their childlike ambitions for a better world in favour of a spirit-crushed submission to the man and his state-sponsored bio-survival tickets, or money as it's more commonly called. That abstract fear has been called FUD, fear, uncertainty and doubt, I think, as the ecological crisis bites, will give way to a direct fear of hunger for more and more people of the world as it becomes clear that the man has no tickets for them that will buy them any food. They will be growing their own food and stepping away from the money-based pyramidal system of control. Now, we're going to hear the end of the John Taylor Gatto interview and listen carefully for an avenue of research that I wish I had the time to follow up, that is the careful destruction of independently produced food in the United States and its replacement with a system that can be hierarchically controlled by a few who could use the threat of food scarcity to control the many. This is by Jan Irvin from Gnostic Media of earlier this year.
All right, well, I have a couple more questions for you if you want to continue. Let me tell you what they are. I've got John Dewey. What has been the effect of school property taxes on small farms? And Edward Bernays.
Oh, let's take all three of those.
Okay.
John Dewey, here is a classic. I mean, Dewey has been whipped, beaten, reviled, not to say he doesn't deserve it, mind you. But Dewey is the famous straw man that misleads you from where the actual villainy lies. Dewey is, from the beginning of his career, the creation of John D. Rockefeller. He's selected, he's placed at the University of Chicago, which was a nothing place until Rockefeller decides to make it the German research university model. And then he becomes very early on the head of the education department, wow, of the German university. And then when he gets that thing running, his lab school there was an utter and absolute failure. That you will never read in a textbook. I read two PhD theses that day by day followed the lab school. When the lab school had become such an embarrassment that it threatened to ruin Dewey, Dewey leaped to which of the thousands of American universities? Why? To Columbia Teachers College. The other Rockefeller Germanic University Division. And Dewey then recreates, I believe, it's called the Lincoln School, but it was his lab school as best he could reconstruct it in New York City. The important thing, I think, for shrewd people, for people who really want to be effective, to hold Dewey in their minds is Dewey was from start to finish a figurehead. If you pick any of his later writing at random, you will see, and this is going to take an effort of moral will because he's not a very good writer, you will see that no matter what posture you want to take, you can find Dewey subscribing to it. In other words, in his writing, he covers all the bases. He doesn't stand for anything. It's just fascinating because I forced myself to read. But in his earlier writing, it's pretty clear that Dewey, taking his orders from from his industrial backers, Dewey says that the new individualism, and this is the locution that shows you he either had a titty or what Dewey calls the new individualism, is that there be no individual positions at all, except those held by major institutions and major corporations. They are, I mean, Dewey's writing this as early, I think it's 1903. He says that the public forum should be preempted by these major economic forces. And if you see an individual in that forum, you can count on the fact that the individual is a front in front of some economic interest. Dewey thought this was a major advance in human society, because all the confusion and all the argument would gradually go away, since all of these major players had a stake in the game, and they all agreed that the game was more important than individual advantage on any. You know, one of the things that young capitalists, and it drives me crazy, but it seems funny also, seem unaware of is that John D. Rockefeller, Andrew Carnegie, they're all on record as saying that competition is a great evil and we have to get rid of it. I guess they read that and they thought, oh, he couldn't mean that.
That's why they all funded communism, was to eliminate the competition.
Well, according to Quigley, the reason they funded communism was, and they funded every radical organization in the world. How's that? When I say funded, they're not huge amounts of money, but they would plant representatives and enough money would be put into it to keep it afloat. Remember when I was a freshman at Cornell University, and a good friend of mine later became a famous author about the Kennedy assassination, Ed Epstein. And I, coming from a mountain town in western Pennsylvania, you know, I'm trying to talk about the communist menace, and Ed starts laughing. And I said, well, what do you mean? Everyone, it's the menace. He said, are you aware that of the 13,000 subscriptions to the Daily Worker, 12,800 of them are taken by U.S. government agencies? My jaw dropped open. Ed's father was on the New York State Supreme Court, so he had a lot of sophisticated contacts when he was in high school. he said the Communist Party would be out of business without U.S. government support. Well, I didn't understand what that meant until Quigley, in a very careful academic, intellectual way, says the decision was made back in the 1890s that by supporting every so-called left-wing organization in the world, that these people who eventually expected to be, the masters of the global government or their sons or their grandsons, would know what everyone was thinking. And they could insert reciprocally ideas through their plants in these organizations back into the mix. But they never would have to worry about being surprised. I also learned from Quigley that the Russian government would have collapsed in the 1920s without Rockefeller sending teams of oil engineers over there to develop the Soviet oil industry, not completely, but to the extent that they have enough money to run their government. It was like a huge, depressing veil fell from my face, and I said, of course. It's like saying right now, in the very moment you and I are living, that there's a tremendous menace from invisible forces whose best military outreach is people who blow their feet up or blow their underwear up. I mean, if you grew up during the Second World War, when at least there was some credible military opposition, it's beyond laughable that people can believe, if that's the best they can produce, that it will be toppled tomorrow. Give me a break.
You want to talk about the effect of school property taxes on small farms?
Yes, of course. I can actually document this to a date, but I'm sure the conversations took place before. If you pick up John Higham's wonderful book about immigration called Strangers in the Land, and you read it slowly with a fine-tooth comb, eventually you're going to run across a footnote that's developed as a backnote, a famous meeting held at Teddy Roosevelt's Oyster Bay mansion right around the time of the First World War. And invited to this meeting, the head of International Harvest of the Big Farm Machinery Company, and other leaders in the American economy and the publicity mechanism. And what Roosevelt says is that as a hostage to good behavior, the government wants to own the food supply. And furthermore, our good friend here from International Harvester says that if these big machines that need open swaths of land were able to tear down all the fences on the small farms, that we could double the food supply, and then we could extend it or withhold it depending on whether the region of the country needs disciplined or rewarded. So he said, we're going to use the credit mechanism to break up the small farms. The other rap against small farms was that the boys and girls who grew up on them knew how to do everything. They were totally self-reliant, and you don't want citizens like that because they tend to be fearless, you know? They're hard to browbeat. So when he talked about the credit mechanism, he meant primarily the mechanism by which you even out the growing cycle, your bad years and good years, but as long as the credit flows evenly, you know, the loans are paid back in the good years, and this has gone way back in in history as long as there has been a credit mechanism. So that is going to be stopped to put the small farmers out of business. But then there are other things you can do. If you raise the property tax in order to, and doesn't it seem like a Boy Scout thing to do the right thing by our young people, herding them into schools, you know, that the farmers can't meet these increased levies. So they have to sell, and guess who's there to buy? It's the factory farmer is going to buy the small things. That'll be enough to chew on for a while, you know. And notice that I didn't have to hesitate. I mean, some of these ideas are so clear, straightforward, and make such good common sense, not moral sense, but social engineering sense, that suddenly we begin to become sophisticated about how social engineering actually takes place, the leverage.
You know, the word sophisticated comes from the word sophist.
Yes, I do know that. And the last question we have.
Edward Bernays.
All right, Edward L. Bernays was, there were a few forerunners, Ivy Lee and a few others, but Edward L. Bernays is the person who created public relations as an academic specialty and as a kind of cloudy specialty in the corporate world. Unlike the sort of straightforward message of advertising, public relations meant to affect changes, good feeling toward a company, without it being obvious what was going on. So one of Bernays' greatest triumphs was convincing American women to smoke. And he paid great-looking women to appear in parades all over the United States, puffing away on cigarettes. He saw to it that key publications would refer to some impressive doll as smoking and so on, and he pulled it off. You know, he doubled the...
He called the cigarettes Liberty Torches or something, didn't he?
Yes. The part that many people aren't aware of is one of Bernays' clients was young Adolf Hitler. Young Adolf Hitler, who was anxious to be in the good graces of Germans. Remember, he came from a low-class background, and there's no country on earth more class-driven than Germany. So Bernays is hired, but he also wants the other countries of Europe, long before he's sending tanks into them, to think well of him, and he wants the United States to think well of him, too. I can tell you from having sat for months in the library stacks at Columbia University and reading every major pop magazine for 4 years before the Second World War started. I didn't read every article. I read the political articles to see how Germany was being regarded. Time, for example, called him almost right up to the declaration of war, Handsome Adolf, because he cut this figure in his tailored uniform.
You know that Henry Luce and C.D. Jackson at Time Life were both psychological warfare, and Henry Luce was working for the Council on Foreign Relations as well.
Yeah, well, some other time we'll have to talk about the CFR and its counterpart.
Skull and Bones was another
letters,
one.
Bases all over Asia.
IMF, is that the one you're talking about?
Yeah, something like that. It's not IMF, but it's I and F and whatever the middle initial is. Yeah, congressional investigations right after the Second World War turned up these unusual ties that this global organization, the CFR in the West and the I-whatever in the East, who Quigley, I mean, maybe some of your listeners want to know, you and I have referred to Quigley a number of times. Quigley was the only man ever allowed private access to the papers of the Council on Foreign Relations. And furthermore, to enhance Quigley's credibility, Quigley says, although it's a huge book, as you know, and you have to read it with a fine-tooth comb, Quigley says that he approves of the project of bringing about a global government. It's just he does not approve of the secrecy.
Right.
So, I mean, there's a nice, fine moral hair to shave, but it doubled my respect for what Quigley was saying, since he said he approved of it.
Right. Well, let me ask you, you mentioned yesterday, and I guess we should repeat it, who was the one source of Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, that you trust?
Oh, he's right out your way. He's either a doctor or a dentist named Stan Monteith, M-O-N-T-E-I-T-H. I think he's up in the Santa Cruz or Santa Clara area, but I know you could Google him. He has a radio show, and wherever they come from, I know that he has a reliable source of Tragedy and Hope. But if you contact him, tell him I remember him fondly. I looked for it for 3 or 4 years. And then suddenly, you know, for whatever way it happened, he was in my life. And when I got the book, I couldn't put it down, which is an awful thing to say with a 1,400-page book. So anyway, this has been a lot of fun. You promised to send me a copy of the transcript.
I sure do. And, you know, let me ask you your parting question. What is the single most important concept that you want people to take away from this interview?
Oh, that getting a young person a first-class education is extremely simple to do. It does not cost virtually anything at all. Money doesn't buy education there. And that I managed to experiment with the unlikeliest kids for at least 15 of the 30 years I taught with wonderful results. Nor was it me. It was simply, and this will be my next book, it was simply doing it the right way. They're hungry to have their minds made muscular. But if you follow the formula of public schooling, you've lost almost all of them, I don't know, by the end of first grade. So that it can be done, and it may be the most revolutionary thing we can do. People who are truly and well-educated are not manageable. That doesn't mean they're revolutionary or they raise hell. It means that they reserve the right to make private judgments, which seems to me to be, you know, the American ideal. Not anymore, but certainly the founding ideal. And I think we can do it. I think we can do it. So that's what I'll leave you with.
And that was the voice of John Taylor Gatto, inspirational teacher for me, who's helped me to relate to the kids as individuals, as I would other human beings. I still have the difficulty of being in a bureaucracy that talks about lesson plans. I've been disciplined for telling the kids that they have a right to inquire why they're learning what they're learning. I don't give them exams because I think they should be motivated themselves to study if they want to study. The red pen of the teacher and the marks which are so easily compared, which they're encouraged to compare with one another, are a proxy for the boss's paycheck. It all works to subsume their own ideas about what is worth doing and use up their time on teacher-defined tasks. Hardly the kind of people who will be able to react autonomously, spontaneously, and intelligently to the many, many ecological and other crises which this world faces if our most reputed scientists are to be believed. It's pretty difficult to imagine a school in which people didn't work for the teacher for exams, unless you've seen it, which is a challenge because most of us haven't. I know it's a challenge because I've been spending years trying to do it. And we're now going to hear from Ivan Illich, who continually impresses me with his ability to see what was happening and to see ways beyond the dilemmas of his time. So this was published 4 decades ago. It's the longest chapter of the book, having gone through in earlier chapters of Deschooling Society the damaging nature of the 20th century's dominant institutions. This chapter he presents an alternative way of doing things. A quarter century before the World Wide Web, he was talking about a mass-use computer system that people could use to share interests, broadcast to other people who had similar interests, and pretty closely defining the World Wide Web, actually. I mean, not just the World Wide Web, Usenet, and in the early days of the Internet, there was little commercial pressure. It was basically made by researchers, and they decided that decentralized was good, and set about building the kind of tools that Illich describes in his book. Now, is Unwelcome Guests a learning web? Well, I don't see it as quite learning or teaching. I mean, I'm continually learning when I'm making these shows, and I certainly learn an awful lot from Lynn. My degree, I did study a degree at university, was mathematics, and didn't have any politics or history or many of the other topics on which I now consider myself most informed. So, if you like, I've spent a decade or so in this kind of person-to-person learning web structure. Not to pass an exam or to make any money, but because I wanted to learn.
Chapter 6 of Ivan Illich, Deschooling Society, Learning Webs. In a previous chapter, I discussed what is becoming a common complaint about schools, one that is reflected, for example, in the recent report of the Carnegie Commission. In school, registered students submit to certified teachers in order to obtain certificates of their own. Both are frustrated and both blame insufficient resources, money, time, or buildings, for their mutual frustration. Such criticism leads many people to ask whether it is possible to conceive of a different style of learning. The same people, paradoxically, when pressed to specify how they acquired what they know and value, will readily admit that they learned it more often outside than inside school. Their knowledge of facts, their understanding of life and work, came to them from friendship or love, while viewing TV, or while reading, from examples of peers or the challenge of a street encounter. Or they may have learned what they know through the apprenticeship ritual for admission to a street gang, or the initiation to a hospital, newspaper city room, plumber shop, or insurance office. The alternative to dependence on schools is not the use of public resources for some new device which makes people learn. Rather, it is the creation of a new style of educational relationship between man and his environment. To foster this style, attitudes towards growing up, the tools available for learning, and the quality and structure of daily life will have to change concurrently. Attitudes are already changing. The proud dependence on school is gone. consumer resistance increases in the knowledge industry. Many teachers and pupils, taxpayers and employers, economists and policemen would prefer not to depend any longer on schools. What prevents their frustration from shaping new institutions is a lack not only of imagination, but frequently also of appropriate language and of enlightened self-interest. They cannot visualize either a de-schooled society or educational institutions in a society which has disestablished school. In this chapter, I intend to show that the inverse of school is possible, that we can depend on self-motivated learning instead of employing teachers to bribe or compel the student to find the time and the will to learn, that we can provide the learner with new links to the world instead of continuing to funnel all educational programs through the teacher. I shall discuss some of the general characteristics which distinguish schooling from learning and outline four major categories of educational institutions which should appeal not only to many individuals, but also to many existing interest groups. An objection: who can be served by bridges to nowhere? We are used to considering schools as a variable, dependent on the political and economic structure. If we can change the style of political leadership, or promote the interest of one class or another, or switch from private to public ownership of the means of production, we assume the school system will change as well. The educational institutions I will propose, however, are meant to serve a society which does not now exist, although the current frustration with schools is itself potentially a major force to set in motion change towards new social arrangements. An obvious objection has been raised to this approach. Why channel energy to build bridges to nowhere, instead of marshaling it first to change not the schools, but the political and economic system? This objection, however, underestimates the fundamental political and economic nature of the school system itself, as well as the political potential inherent in any effective challenge to it. In a basic sense, schools have ceased to be dependent on the ideology professed by any government or market organization. Other basic institutions might differ from one country to another: family, party, church, or press. But everywhere the school system has the same structure, and everywhere its hidden curriculum has the same effect. Invariably, it shapes the consumer who values institutional commodities above the non-professional ministration of a neighbor. Everywhere, the hidden curriculum of schooling initiates the citizen to the myth that bureaucracies guided by scientific knowledge are efficient and benevolent. Everywhere, this same curriculum instills in the pupil the myth that increased production will provide a better life. And everywhere it develops the habit of self-defeating consumption of services and alienating production. The tolerance for institutional dependence and the recognition of institutional rankings. The hidden curriculum of school does all this in spite of contrary efforts undertaken by teachers and no matter what ideology prevails. In other words, schools are fundamentally alike in all countries, be they fascist, democratic, or socialist, big or small, rich or poor. This identity of the school system forces us to recognize the profound worldwide identity of myth, mode of production, and method of social control, despite the great variety of mythologies in which the myth finds expression. In view of this identity, it is illusory to claim that schools are, in any profound sense, dependent variables. This means that to hope for fundamental change in the school system as an effect of conventionally conceived social or economic change is also an illusion. Moreover, this illusion grants the school, the reproductive organ of a consumer society, almost unquestioned immunity. It is at this point that the example of China becomes important. For three millennia, China protected higher learning through a total divorce between the process of learning and the privilege conferred by Mandarin examinations. To become a world power and a modern nation-state, China had to adopt the international style of schooling. Only hindsight will allow us to discover if the Great Cultural Revolution will turn out to have been the first successful attempt at de-schooling the institutions of society. Even the piecemeal creation of new educational agencies, which were the inverse of school, would be an attack on the most sensitive link of a pervasive phenomenon, which is organized by the state in all countries. A political program which does not explicitly recognize the need for deschooling is not revolutionary. It is demagoguery calling for more of the same. Any major political program of the 70s should be evaluated by this measure. How clearly does it state the need for deschooling? And how clearly does it provide guidelines for the educational quality of the society for which it aims? The struggle against domination by the world market and big power politics might be beyond some poor communities or countries. But this weakness is an added reason for emphasizing the importance of liberating each society through a reversal of its educational structure, a change which is not beyond any society's means. General characteristics of new formal educational institutions. A good educational system should have three purposes. It should provide all who want to learn with access to available resources at any time in their lives. Empower all who want to share what they know to find those who want to learn it from them. And finally, furnish all who want to present an issue to the public with the opportunity to make their challenge known. Such a system would require the application of constitutional guarantees to education. Learners should not be forced to submit to an obligatory curriculum or to discrimination based on whether they possess a certificate or a diploma. Nor should the public be forced to support, through a regressive taxation, a huge professional apparatus of educators and buildings, which in fact restricts the public's chances for learning to the services the profession is willing to put on the market. It should use modern technology to make free speech, free assembly, and a free press truly universal and therefore fully educational. Schools are designed on the assumption that there is a secret to everything in life, that the quality of life depends on knowing that secret, that secrets can be known only in orderly successions, and that only teachers can properly reveal these secrets. An individual with a schooled mind conceives of the world as a pyramid of classified packages accessible only to those who carry the proper tags. New educational institutions would break apart this pyramid. Their purpose must be to facilitate access for the learner, to allow him to look into the windows of the control room or the parliament, if he cannot get in by the door. Moreover, such new institutions should be channels to which the learner would have access without credentials or pedigree, public spaces in which peers and elders outside his immediate horizon would become available. I believe that no more than 4, possibly even 3, distinct channels or learning exchanges could contain all the resources needed for real learning. The child grows up in a world of things, surrounded by people who serve as models for skills and values. He finds peers who challenge him to argue, to compete, to cooperate, and to understand. And if the child is lucky, he is exposed to confrontation or criticism by an experienced elder who really cares. Things, models, peers, and elders are 4 resources, each of which requires a different type of arrangement to ensure that everybody has ample access to it. I will use the words opportunity web for network to designate specific ways to provide access to each of 4 sets of resources. Network is often used, unfortunately, to designate the channels reserved to material selected by others for indoctrination, instruction, and entertainment. But it can also be used for the telephone or the postal service, which are primarily accessible to individuals who want to send messages to one another. I wish we had another word to designate such reticular structures for mutual access, a word less evocative of entrapment, less degraded by current usage, and more suggestive of the fact that any such arrangement includes legal, organizational, and technical aspects. Not having found such a term, I will try to redeem the one which is available, using it as a synonym of educational web. What are needed are new networks, readily available to the public and designed to spread equal opportunity for learning and teaching. To give an example, the same level of technology is used in TV and in tape recorders. All Latin American countries now have introduced TV. In Bolivia, the government has financed a TV station, which was built 6 years ago, and there are no more than 7,000 TV sets for 4 million citizens. The money now tied up in TV installations throughout Latin America could have provided every fifth adult with a tape recorder. In addition, the money would have sufficed to provide an almost unlimited library of pre-recorded tapes, with outlets even in remote villages, as well as an ample supply of empty tapes. This network of tape recorders, of course, would be radically different from the present network of TV. It would provide opportunity for free expression. Literate and illiterate alike could record, preserve, disseminate, and repeat their opinions. The present investment in TV, instead, provides bureaucrats, whether politicians or educators, with the power to sprinkle the continent with institutionally produced programs, which they or their sponsors decide are good for or in demand by the people. Technology is available to develop either independence and learning or bureaucracy and teaching. Four networks. The planning of new educational institutions ought not to begin with the administrative goals of a principal or president, or with the teaching goals of a professional educator, or with the learning goals of any hypothetical class of people. It must not start with the question, what should someone learn, but with the question, what kinds of things and people might learners want to be in contact with in order to learn? Someone who wants to learn knows that he needs both information and critical response to its use from somebody else. Information can be stored in things and in persons. In a good educational system, access to things ought to be available at the sole bidding of the learner, while access to informants requires, in addition, others' consent. Criticism can also come from two directions, from peers or from elders, that is, from fellow learners whose immediate interests match mine, or from those who will grant me a share in their superior experience. Peers can be colleagues with whom to raise a question, companions for playful and enjoyable or arduous reading or walking, challengers at any type of game. Elders can be consultants on which skill to learn, which method to use, what company to seek at a given moment. They can be guides to the right questions to be raised among peers and to the deficiencies of the answers they arrive at. Most of these resources are plentiful, but they are neither conventionally perceived as educational resources, nor is access to them for learning purposes easy, especially for the poor. We must conceive of new relational structures which are deliberately set up to facilitate access to these resources for the use of anybody who is motivated to seek them for his education. Administrative, technological, and especially legal arrangements are required to set up such web-like structures. Educational resources are usually labeled according to educators' curricular goals. I propose to do the contrary, to label four different approaches which enable the student to gain access to any educational resource which may help him to define and achieve his own goals. Number 1, reference services to educational objects which facilitate access to things or processes used for formal learning. Some of these things can be reserved for this purpose, stored in libraries, rental agencies, laboratories, and showrooms like museums and theaters. Others can be in daily use in factories, airports, or on farms, but made available to students as apprentices or on off hours. Number 2, skill exchanges, which permit persons to list their skills, the conditions under which they are willing to serve as models for others who want to learn these skills, and the addresses at which they can be reached. Number 3, peer matching, a communications network which permits persons to describe the learning activity in which they wish to engage in the hope of finding a partner for the inquiry. Number 4, reference services to educators at large, who can be listed in a directory given the addresses and self-descriptions of professionals, paraprofessionals, and freelancers, along with conditions of access to their services. Such educators, as we will see, could be chosen by polling or consulting their former clients. Reference services to educational objects. Things are basic resources for learning. The quality of the environment and the relationship of a person to it will determine how much he learns incidentally. Formal learning requires special access to ordinary things, on the one hand, or, on the other, easy and dependable access to special things made for educational purposes. An example of the former is the special right to operate or dismantle a machine in a garage. An example of the latter is the general right to use an abacus, a computer, a book, a botanical garden, or a machine withdrawn from production and placed at the full disposal of students. At present, attention is focused on the disparity between rich and poor children in their access to things and in the manner in which they can learn from them. OEO and other agencies, following this approach, concentrate on equalizing chances by trying to provide more educational equipment for the poor. A more radical point of departure would be to recognize that in the city, rich and poor alike are artificially kept away from most of the things that surround them. Children born into the age of plastics and efficiency experts must penetrate two barriers which obstruct their understanding, one built into things and the other around institutions. Industrial design creates a world of things that resist insight into their nature, and schools shut the learner out of the world of things and their meaningful setting. After a short visit to New York, a woman from a Mexican village told me she was impressed by the fact that stores sold only wares heavily made up with cosmetics. I understood her to mean that industrial products speak to their customers about their allurements and not about their nature. Industry has surrounded people with artifacts whose inner workings only specialists are allowed to understand. The non-specialist is discouraged from figuring out what makes a watch tick, or a telephone ring, or an electric typewriter work, by being warned that it will break if he tries. He can be told what makes a transistor radio work, but he cannot find out for himself. This type of design tends to reinforce a non-inventive society in which the experts find it progressively easier to hide behind their expertise and beyond evaluation. The man-made environment has become as inscrutable as nature is for the primitive. At the same time, educational materials have been monopolized by school. Simple educational objects have been expensively packaged by the knowledge industry. They have become specialized tools for professional educators, and their cost has been inflated by forcing them to stimulate either environments or teachers. The teacher is jealous of the textbook he defines as his professional implement. The student may come to hate the lab because he associates it with schoolwork. The administrator rationalizes his protective attitude toward the library as a defense of costly public equipment against those who would play with it rather than learn. In this atmosphere, the student too often uses the map, the lab, the encyclopedia, or the microscope only at the rare moments when the curriculum tells him to do so. Even the great classics become part of sophomore year instead of marking a new turn in a person's life. School removes things from everyday use by labeling them educational tools. If we are to de-school, both tendencies must be reversed. The general physical environment must be made accessible, and those physical learning resources, which have been reduced to teaching instruments, must become generally available for self-directed learning. Using things only as part of a curriculum can have an even worse effect than just removing them from the general environment. It can corrupt the attitudes of pupils. Games are a case in point. I do not mean the games of the physical education department, such as football and basketball, which the schools use to raise income and prestige, and in which they have made a substantial capital investment. As the athletes themselves are well aware, these enterprises, which take the form of warlike tournaments, have undermined the playfulness of sports and are used to reinforce the competitive nature of schools. Rather, I have in mind the educational games which can provide a unique way to penetrate formal systems. Set theory, linguistics, propositional logic, geometry, physics, and even chemistry reveal themselves with little effort to certain persons who play these games.